Hey everyone, Patrick Brown, your host here. Welcome to another episode of Crown and Crozier. For this episode, we're casting a glance back in the rearview mirror and reviewing the biggest stories from the world of church, state, and faithful citizenship from 2021. We touch on the first year of the Biden administration, the implications of a Biden presidency for Eucharistic coherence, how the church has fared during year two of the COVID pandemic, the launch of the Synod on Synodality, and more. Our guest is Dr. Robert Royal, founder and president of the Faith and Reason Institute in Washington, D.C., editor-in-chief of The Catholic Thing, and author, editor, and translator of 15 books. You may know him best for his regular appearances as a member of the Papal Posse on EWTN's flagship news program, The World Over with Raymond Arroyo. As 2021 draws to a close, we want to extend a sincere thanks to all of our listeners for tuning into Crown and Crozier and for helping to make our inaugural year and our entry into the Catholic podcast sphere a smashing success. We're incredibly grateful for your support. If you don't mind us trespassing upon your good graces for one last time this year, we'd ask for a little Yuletide cheer from you in the form of a rating on Apple or Spotify, a festive referral to someone in your circle, or a shout out on your social media platform of choice. Or if you're really looking to get into the holiday spirit or onto St. Nick's nice list, visit our website at crownandcrozier.com to learn more about how you can become a supporter of the show. Thanks so much. Enjoy this installment of Crown and Crozier, and we'll see you again in the new year.
There are two swords, and the question is, which sword is superior, the spiritual sword or the temporal sword?
And without God, democracy will not and cannot long endure.
I die His Majesty's good servant at God's first.
Joining us for this episode of Crown and Crozier is Dr. Robert Royal. Dr. Royal, thanks very much for being here.
Great to be with you.
So I don't think it's any understatement to say that on the domestic, North American, international stages, 2021 featured actions and events of enormous consequence, both for the church and the state alike. So to start our year in review episode, we'd love to get your take on what was the most significant development from the past 12 months. So when you look back on 2021 and survey all things church and state, what stands out the most for you?
Well, that's a difficult question. And I guess we're going to start with a difficult question and then move on from there. Look, I think that the ongoing COVID presence is something that you could just look at in terms of public health or medicine or science. But I think events like this really do have a spiritual dimension as well. And we see how not only has this caused a disruption in the world, it's also brought forward in the church debates over, you know, how vaccines are tested, whether these things can be imposed on people. And all that already feeds into something that already existed, and that is the kind of crisis that we have in our democracy. Whatever party seems to be in power these days, because not only in the United States, but I get the impression also in Canada and even in Europe to a certain extent, there's a division among people. And again, I would say that this COVID time has brought this clearer into focus for us. There's a division between the parts of the culture, the society, that are more attached to the more traditional side of both the faith and our political traditions. And those are, you could call it radical, you could call it revolutionary, you could call it innovative, depending on how you view the developments. But there really is about a 50-50 split, at least here in America, maybe a little bit less of a cleavage in other countries. But I think we see how the virus has actually made those cleavages even more visible than they were previously.
And what's your take on how the church has navigated that situation? And what's your take on the cleavages that have manifested themselves and have arguably become more acute during this time of pandemic within the church?
Well, I think that the church has got a very uneven record with response to this period that we've been in. There have been parts of it, I think, that have tried to strike a good balance between liberty and responsibility. And of course, that's one of the main debates in all our public lives these days. How much is freedom extended in various spheres, and how much is it limited by the common good or by our responsibilities towards other people. Where I live just outside of Washington, D.C. in Northern Virginia. I mean, I think our diocese has done rather well. We rather quickly moved off the masked mass regimes and got people back into parishes. From what I understand, in other places, that's not been so much the case. I think in larger, more universal terms, I'm not quite sure that Rome has helped itself. It seems to me that there's been a tendency to just look at the debates that exist as if it's selfishness versus the common good responsibility. I don't think that that's how it should be looked at. Some people are resistant to the virus, and they are resistant for various, for the vaccine, I'm sorry. They're resistant for various reasons. Some don't like the fact, as is well known, that these vaccines were developed often by testing on what may have been aborted fetal cells. Some resist because they have health concerns. They are nervous about their health for one reason or another, and they fear some of the side effects that have been actually well documented. And some just don't like the idea of national and international bodies kind of imposing this on them. So it's complicated, and I think that both the Pope and the Vatican in general have rather simplified all that. I don't think we have to take an absolutist moral position. We ask people to be responsible. We ask them to use their freedom the way God intended them to use it. But there has to be some space left for differing reactions because different people exist in different individual circumstances. And I'm rather disappointed, actually, because I think I'm fully vaccinated myself, so I'm not saying anything against vaccines. But I'm a bit disappointed because there are so many threats to our liberties and to our personal consciences in modern societies that I don't think that the church has helped very much, given the unique character of this the threat of COVID.
And there's an argument to be made. The statement that the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith released about a year ago, essentially outlining the core teaching of the church with respect to vaccines and affirming that a person of faith, a member of the church, could receive a vaccine in good conscience, but a member of the church could also decline one in good conscience. And these were prudential decisions that were left to the discretion, the judgment, the good conscience of the individual member of the church. And I can't help but think that that message has got lost somewhere in translation and implementation, depending on the diocese you live in or the country where you reside. And I wonder if how the church has handled the pandemic has clouded questions around moral imperatives and prudential judgments. And I can't help but think that that doesn't bode well for the future.
Yeah, the document that you cite, I think, it absolutely presents the classical Catholic approach to these questions. You know, it's called remote cooperation in evil. But you know, I mean, you obviously can't live in the world if you want to isolate yourself entirely from everything that proceeds from, you know, some evil process. You couldn't buy a book from a publisher because perhaps that same publisher publishes pornography or something that's blasphemous. And, you know, you can see more substantial, I mean, obviously take a trivial case, but you can even see more substantial cases of this, that we all benefit to a certain degree from things that happened while North America had slaves, for example. And so there's always been this understanding that to live in the world at all, one has to distinguish between direct cooperations with evil and remote cooperations with evil. And so that's what that document was getting at. As I said, unfortunately, I think in particular, Pope Francis, for all his good intentions, I don't think he means ill by it, but I think that there's just a much more simple approach to what these questions have presented us with. Individuals have all sorts of different reasons for taking the choices that they do, whether they get the vaccines or don't, or the way they even look at what the threats of the virus are. These things are not necessarily defeated. There are things that people have to think through. And when one of the benefits, it seems to me, that the virus brings, because I think if you're a believer, you have to think that God has some prudential, you know, he's got some providential goal in mind in allowing this virus to transpire around the world. I think he's made us reflect on a number of things and how little, I mean, science, I'm a great believer in science, real science, but how little science is able to control something like this. You know, what many different approaches have been tried in different countries. No one seems to have done particularly well. There have been slightly better and slightly worse approaches, and those change as the virus is mutated into different forms. You cannot engineer a society the way you can engineer, say, a drug in a laboratory, or you can engineer a bridge. That human beings are just, they're not malleable that way. And we have to kind of come to an understanding of who we are and what it means to live in a human society. So all those things, I think, and many more. I mean, we've confronted death in ways that our societies haven't in the past. We've confronted threats. We've confronted being isolated from one another in a way that we haven't in the past. All this, it seems to me, is in a way a providential challenge to what perhaps was a much easier life than we had, maybe even as little as 2 years ago.
Yeah, and that's an interesting point. And I wonder, in the midst of what may have been, in the mysteries of providence, God allowing this all to unravel and to unfold, what's your sense on how the church demonstrated its role and its mission at a time like this? We've heard criticism in various corners that throughout this pandemic, what the church has to offer to its members and to the world in a time in a crisis like this seems to have been a little unclear at times, because the response from the church or some corners of the church has seemed to have been indistinguishable from the quote-unquote world in dealing with this virus. And it seems to me, and it seems to many folks, that I don't mean to be use too much of business jargon here, but should be able to articulate a very clear value proposition. And I mean, the church should demonstrate what it's here for, what its role is, what its mission is, particularly in a time like this. How would you grade the church's performance in that regard?
Well, parts of it, I think, have been quite inspiring. I thought that the Holy Father, back in January, when he did that lone prayer service, I think that was very, very moving. And I think the idea of us petitioning God the Father to help us through a plague, and plagues have occurred throughout history, before Christian times and all during Christian history as well, I think that was very, very moving. That could have been built on, that type of prayer, in time of pestilence, if we want to put it that way. I think the church was less brave, less spiritual, in kind of accepting the way that the secular world just banned spiritual succoring of God's people. You know, lots of people died without last rites.
Yeah.
Lots of people died not only without their families surrounding them, but without that last spiritual viaticum that traditionally we used to give to people who we knew were on the verge of going on to the next world. So that, I think, is a disappointment. I would have liked to have seen the church push harder on that people had a right. I think that the technical side of this, the scientific and medical side of that, could have been managed, just as it is when health professionals go in and treat somebody who has COVID. They wear protective gear. I mean, we could have forced that issue. I think we were very lax in not pushing harder back in allowing people to meet in churches again. I mean, people met in all sorts of different contexts, secular contexts, and protected themselves or careful about how they did it. It's precisely in times like this that you need that sort of special spiritual power that exists in joining together in person, in prayer, in sacred places. Now, you know, I don't want to denigrate the online attendance at masses. I think that was all a good bridge. But we don't believe that death is the worst thing that can happen to a person. Mm-hmm. We have to, I mean, by the way we act, I think what you were trying to get at by the way you act, you articulate something that distinguishes you from the rest of the world, which is just terrified about death. We don't like death. We know that Christ has conquered death, and we still have fears and we have worries about it. But we have to act differently, I think, than the world. And I don't think that in most instances, believing Christians or even others made it clear that their hope isn't always in surviving just physically.
Let's pray during this season of Advent we can renew that faith and confidence in the grace and the reality of our Lord's incarnation. And what that means for us. I want to pivot to a second big story and an event from 2021, the Biden presidency. The day after President Biden was sworn in, you published a column headlined, "Our First Anti-Catholic Catholic President." So we're about 1 year into the Biden administration. May I ask, does that description of the administration and the presidency still hold true in your mind?
I was too easy on it.
Okay. Go on.
Look, people think, I'll spell this out. Look, people think that the only reason some of us, regard President Joe Biden as an anti-Catholic Catholic is because of abortion. Or perhaps because of gay marriage, because he performed a gay marriage when he was vice president. But that's just the tip of the iceberg. As horrible as his record has been on abortion, I mean, at one point he was semi-Catholic in his beliefs, and then like many Democrats, he became personally opposed. And now he's actually at the point where he's come out and just said, look, I don't believe that human life begins at conception, and then blah, blah, blah. But that's just the beginning. Because those debates, those legal and social challenges are played out in the courts. What his administration has done, and you could argue that he's not very much in control of the administration. He's not in control of it with regard to things like the border or the withdrawal from Afghanistan was a disaster, I believe. And you could point to other things as well. But his administration, which is staffed with quite a few Catholics, by the way, has been, in my judgment, the most anti-Catholic in terms of the way it operates. And I don't mean only at the level of abortion, although it's been pushing abortion, so-called abortion rights, everywhere it can. I mean, the minute they took office and the minute he was in the White House, they went back to suing the Little Sisters of the Poor for not covering contraception and their health insurance for their employees. We start to see that Health and Human Services, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Javier Becerra, who I think also is a Catholic, he was already a radical in California in pushing these sorts of things into every nook and cranny where, you know, private organizations, religious organizations have a great deal of legal pressure put on them to conform to moral positions that are repugnant to their moral theology. And so I just don't see how you can look at what he's doing. I remember some stories back when Obamacare was being produced that Biden tried to actually reel in the Obama administration in the ways that it was trying to pressure religious institutions, and not only churches or schools, but hospitals, you know, adoption agencies, poverty agencies, I mean, right across the whole spectrum of places where government and civil society intersect. So I don't think I was exaggerating at all. I mean, I didn't know it was going to become as radical as it has become, but I had strong suspicions that that's where it was going to go. And in fact, I don't think you can find anywhere in the record over almost a year of the Biden administration where you'll see that they have pulled back because of some respect for religious beliefs. It seems to me that they've just decided they're all in on homogenizing what the government is going to allow and not allow in those hot button areas where they could allow some space for civil society and still promote whatever it is that they want to promote. But it's clear that they've got the intention of homogenizing the society as much as they possibly can. And for me, that's anti-Catholic.
I think that's spot on. Based on everything that you've just said, juxtaposing that with the president's relatively recent visit to the Vatican and that historic, in all the wrong senses of the word, that historic statement around describing the conversation with the Pope and sharing the purported response from the Pope around Mr. Biden being a good Catholic and should be able to continue receiving communion. And in light of everything that you've just said, when you heard those words, what were you thinking? And how do you possibly make sense of that in light of everything that you've just described as the record of the administration thus far?
Well, it's difficult to know how much to credit what Joe Biden said, because he's got a long dossier of saying self-serving things that aren't true. And that was my first reaction, frankly. And if you look at what he said when he was asked about did abortion come up, at first he said no, the issue didn't come up. We talked about climate and refugees and whatnot. And then he said it did, and he said, I'm a good Catholic and I should continue to. So there was a contradiction already in what he said. Now, this brings me to a certain frustration I have with Pope Francis, frankly, because on the one hand, he has spoken out, I think, more strongly than any prior Pope about the outrage of abortion. He's called getting an abortion hiring a hitman to solve a problem. I mean, he's essentially said it's tantamount to the mafia, and he's excommunicated mafia members in Italy. He's put that word out. But while he says that, and I think in some respects he does deeply believe that, the other side of him, I think, functions as a kind of a politician. And so here he realizes that this is perhaps the human rights issue of our time and a great outrage. There are 65 million babies destroyed in the womb worldwide every year, far beyond any war that's going on, people dying in refugee camps, all the other things that he's concerned about, people trying to get across the Mediterranean in leaky boats, and et cetera. It's a massive slaughter of innocence, of the innocents. And yet when he meets with people, and I think it was deeply, deeply imprudent of the Pope to meet with both Pelosi and Biden just at the point that they knew that the American bishops were meeting together to talk about what to do with prominent American politicians who take up obvious moral positions, and not only take them up, but vigorously promote them in the public square, that are opposed to Catholicism. And on top of that, as we know, just in the past few weeks, our Supreme Court in the United States is now hearing cases of state laws that are curtailing abortion, and we're going to see where those go to. So between receiving those two people just before our bishops are meeting and just before our Supreme Court is meeting, seems to me but it's an action that contradicts the words of the Pope, the very words of the Pope himself. I'm deeply puzzled by this. I have been. I've been following this papacy since he was elected in 2013. And it makes no sense to me to have that clarity about how awful the world abortion situation is, and yet at the same time, essentially to do nothing and maybe even to give some comfort and assistance to those who want to prolong the abortion regime that we have.
Just to round out this line of discussion, we're coming up on the one year anniversary of the inauguration of President Biden. I was reflecting the other day, you know, this is number two in terms of Catholics occupying the Oval Office, with the first stint being JFK for an abbreviated first term. And you just kind of sit back and think, like, this is our second kick at the can in terms of Catholics serving in the Oval Office. And my goodness, what a legacy, what a record we're showing for ourselves. What are your thoughts as you reflect at the end of this first year of the Biden administration? I know it sounds trite, but I mean, good Lord, this is not the best we can do. How do we do things differently?
Get better candidates. No, it's ironic if you think about it, that JFK was initially opposed by Protestant leaders in the country because they were fearful that he was going to impose Catholic doctrine, that the Pope was actually going to be dictating policy in the United States. And with Biden, we have the exact opposite problem. You have evangelicals wanting him to be more Christian because of the kind of problems that they perceive in how he handles himself in office. I won't speak about Canada, but I have to say that here in the United States, we're going through a critical reevaluation of what our democracy is, that as many people have said, and this isn't only within the church, that there's a kind of elite culture that's emerging that is quite radical. And you know, the whole trans movement, which I think is just crazy. There's no other word to describe it. To be tolerant of people who have gender dysphoria is one thing. To be aggressive in promoting it the way our elite culture and our White House now, frankly, has been. I mean, they've made appointees, and this is sort of in your face. It's very clear that they're by their actions, they're trying to instruct the rest of American society, about half of which, by the way, violently opposes these things. Mm-hmm. There's no attempt to be moderate the way Biden has talked about. If he had done that, if he had been willing to allow some spaces, you know, we used to talk about civil society when the Soviet Union was still around. They had obliterated these private associations that have been so important in the United States. And not only our religious bodies, but, you know, our voluntary associations, which have been the hallmark of North American civilization, because there was nothing here. We had to build everything up from scratch. You know, there's a famous line in de Tocqueville's Democracy in America, where he says, where in France, you would see the state, in America, you see a private association. And that used to be the strength of our country. We made room for difference. We tried to live and let live. We had violent differences of opinion and sometimes social clashes. But now we're in the situation where we have a nominal Catholic who is trying to impose a kind of new religiosity. Some people have actually called it a religion, this sort of woke religion that exists in elite circles, in universities, in media, Hollywood, etc. It's dizzying. I think there's a better way. I think there's a better way for people to even be religiously more tolerant of one another. And it particularly disturbs me as a Roman Catholic that Biden claims to be Catholic and I think does things that no Catholic should be proud of.
Let's use that to segue into the document that the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops developed this year, which was so closely watched, the Mystery of the Eucharist and the Life of the Church, which was issued at their November assembly in Baltimore. I've taken the time to read the document. I'll say it's generally very well written, very instructive, but I couldn't help but think after concluding it, the conditions that existed prior to the document's formulation, i.e. this challenge of very prominent Catholics, self-professed Catholics in positions of authority, they're exactly the same as the conditions that exist subsequent to the document's release. And that's not a eureka revelation. Everybody knows that. But certainly the million-dollar question that everyone's asking is, well, what next? What do we do with this thing? And I'm curious to hear your thoughts on predictions for what comes next.
I know several of the people who were involved in the writing of that document, and they're very sound people. And as you rightly say, if you read that document, it probably is well written as anything trying to do what it tries to do could be. It lays out the nature of the Eucharist very clearly. It makes it clear that if you are not in full communion with the Catholic Church, either theologically, morally, etc., you should not present yourself for communion. And I have several friends. I haven't particularly gone out of my way to criticize the document, but I do criticize what the bishops did, because there's a difference between, if I can use some ancient philosophical terms, logic and rhetoric. The logic here is impeccable. What the bishops laid down there, I think, is classic Catholic teaching put in terms that apply to our time. But as you rightly say, people who look at the event as a whole, the bishops meeting, they're writing about this, the controversy, the sometimes conflicts with messages coming in from Rome. At the end of the day, what they see is a lot of nice words, but the situation is identical. And so the message, what got said is true and good and right. And what was heard is something entirely different. But what was heard is that, yeah, the church has got these teachings, but the church leaders are not going to do anything about it. Now, that said, I do hear through the grapevine that various bishops now feel that they have at their back the support of their brother bishops. 202 bishops who voted in favor of the document, but they have at their back in support of anything that they would like to do to curtail local politicians who may have national offices but reside in their diocese. They have the added authority to do something about them. I think we're already seeing in places like San Francisco, some places in Texas, there have been a couple of cases in New England and elsewhere of bishops speaking out and saying that you shouldn't present yourself for communion and telling specific people that they should present themselves for communion.
Wow, okay.
But whether that will become a more widespread phenomenon, I'm doubtful. We already have our Cardinal Archbishop here in Washington, D.C., who said he will not block the president from taking communion. Joe Biden's bishop in Delaware has said essentially the same thing. So, look, I'm glad the bishops wrote what they wrote. I wish they had done more than they did.
Mm-hmm. And among the considerations we're all wrestling with, I mean, I'll just share a few things that have come to mind more and more. One, I can't help but think that an offshoot of this whole situation will be a perception inside and outside the church that some members of the laity are just beyond reproach. It kind of begs the question, like, what more does a member of the church need to do before you receive some kind of sanction? And I think that question remains as open-ended as ever. And then on the flip side, Vatican II has taught us that every member of the church has an obligation to respond to the universal call to holiness and whatever station that they occupy in life. And when it comes to matters of public affairs, the laity is called to sanctify the public square. And again, this isn't a eureka revelation or anything, but I just wonder if what happens next in terms of the implementation of this document, it seems like we are, I don't know, irrevocably is a strong word, but just ceding so much ground in terms of the role of the laity in sanctifying the public square when the most high profile self-professed members of the church in the public square in North America are actively undermining church teaching and the church's mission.
Yeah, I think that's very well stated. I mean, to go back to this point, you can say certain things and you can even mean them. And I think the Pope does this too, but when your actions don't, I'm going to use a very American term that our philosopher William James once used, the cash value of these philosophical principles, by which he meant the way that, you know, it has some practical effect in the world. If it doesn't have that practical effect in the world, then there's something wrong in the way that it's being conceptualized somehow. And, you know, I would like to have heard, maybe not in the discussion about the document itself, which could be, you know, kind of a separate activity, but I would like to have heard far more, you know, groups of bishops standing up and saying, you know, we, in rather emotional terms, we mean this. We mean that, you know, if you are an American politician who has gone down the rabbit hole, as I've got to be somewhat partisan about this, frankly, I don't intend to be because there are unfaithful people in all political parties, but I think the Democratic Party has created a kind of creed of its own. There are a few pro-life Democrats, and I always say if you are going to be a Democrat, then you simply cannot accept certain parts of where the mainstream of the Democratic Party is right now. If you want to be with them on, I don't know, climate or poverty questions or immigration, I mean, those are debatable, prudential questions. But you can't be with them on the radical attempt to validate trans ideology in the world. Even the Pope has talked about this as ideological colonization that the developed countries are trying to carry out. So, I think you're right. We've ceded a lot of public space, and there are other things yet to be done besides just writing words down on a piece of paper. How that's going to take place, I don't think it's going to take place with this papacy, because this papacy has clearly tried to use the term pastoral to mean that we'll be accepting and in dialogue with every position. And that's, I'm sure if you ask the Pope, why did you meet with Biden right before the bishops were going to meet? He would say, well, he's the head of a very important country and we have to be in dialogue with every country. And maybe, who knows, maybe he did say something privately that he can't report on because he kind of thinks of it in terms of the seal of the confessional. But we need something public. You're right. Whether it's just the appearance of the reality, the appearances certainly look as if the church has shown itself to be impotent.
Agreed. And you know, if nothing else, the experience of this document and reading it and wondering about what comes next, if nothing else, it does make me grateful for the example of the handful of brave individual priests that we've seen take a stand when it comes to these things. I remember the South Carolina priest who had the courage to deny communion to then Vice President Biden, I believe, or candidate Biden. But if nothing else, it makes me grateful for those examples and certainly praying for more of that. Just one quick aside on the document, as I was reading through it, I admit I was anticipating, maybe hoping against hope, that in a document focused on the mystery of the Eucharist, there might be a bit of discussion on things like the mode of reception of the Eucharist by the laity, going into things like, is there any merit to trying to reclaim or restore some of the practices like kneeling for communion or using altar rails or receiving communion on the tongue? And there wasn't really any of that in the document, which I was a little disappointed by. And that's just a personal beef of mine. But even when I saw how the document was structured, you know, there was a whole section on the gift of the Eucharist. And I couldn't help but think, well, if the Eucharist is gift, why don't we spend some time on how you properly receive this gift? What do you make of all that? Am I making a mountain out of a molehill? Or
no, I think
was there a missed opportunity here?
Yeah, I think there was a missed opportunity. There's a lot of good stuff in there about the nature of the Eucharist. I think we have to say that. But look, I know several bishops who privately and sometimes publicly will say that we put ourselves on the path of thinking that everybody can come forward for communion. And again, unfortunately, I think Pope Francis has in different forums said he would never deny anybody who comes forward for communion. He will give it to anybody. But I know some bishops who have said that by, again, our physical actions, the fact that we don't kneel, the fact that we don't receive on the tongue, prepared the way for people to be just a bit more casual about what the Eucharist is. And we know one of the good things about the document is at least it's teaching again what the Eucharist is, because as we know from surveys, at least 2/3, maybe almost 3/4 of so-called Catholics in the United States, again, I don't know about other places, but in the United States, I think over 70% of self-identified Catholics don't know what the church teaching is about the real presence of Jesus's body and blood in the bread and wine in the Eucharist. So, you know, Vatican II, you mentioned earlier, talked about the universal call to holiness and the responsibility of the laity, and, you know, presumably everybody was going to become better educated in Catholic doctrine. I mean, we have all these educational resources now and things like this, like the internet, that can convey information and formation for people that we never had in the past. It's possible to reach people. So is it the case that for the past 60 years, the church in the United States has not really been reaching people with the teaching? I think you have to say, given what people now think, that it hasn't. I mean, as much as certain bishops have really worked at this, and, you know, we hear now that there are going to be initiatives on a renewal of appreciation of the Eucharist, and that's all to the good. But, that would be a long slog. And in the meantime, all that most people understand is that You can pass out those wafers to anybody who comes forward.
Mm-hmm. Well, I understand to your point just now. There are plans around a Eucharistic Congress to take place in the United States in the coming years. So, one hopes and prays that there will be fruit from this document. But as you say, there are reasons for question marks around that. We hope and pray otherwise, but we'll have to see how that all plays out. With our remaining time, I want to pivot a little bit beyond North America for some Vatican inside baseball. Some of the developments that we saw emerge from the Holy See this year, I want to make sure we have the benefit of your thoughts on that. I'm going to start with the Synod. For the benefit of our listeners who haven't been following it super closely, the Synod was initiated in the last couple of months as an opportunity to examine how the church is journeying together, particularly at the local level, how the Holy Spirit is inviting the church to grow and journey together as a church. And essentially, this is an opportunity, the Vatican says, to look at the form, style, structure of the church in journeying together. You've written extensively and commented extensively on the Synod. Just like to tee it up and hear your thoughts in terms of your expectations for where this whole process is going and what fruits, if any, you see emerging from this.
Well, it might be an understatement to say I'm not expecting much from this process. I've been at every one of the recent synods since Pope Francis has been Pope. And what I've seen at each one of them is that, yeah, there is some discussion, you know, some interesting points are raised here and there. But essentially, it's the bureaucracy in Rome that decides what is going to be the message that comes out of, and eventually, of course, the Holy Father, the message that comes out of the synods. Now, the synod you're referring to now, of course, is a synod on synods, a synod on synodality. And the plan, just in case the listeners are not familiar with this, the plan is to consult with approximately something like 120,000 Catholics around the entire world in various dioceses and get input from them. Now, it doesn't take somebody who's steeped in politics to realize that the politically active type of Catholic is the one who's going to make the most noise. I mean, we just heard this past week about a group called New Ways Ministry, which for decades has been promoting homosexuality in the church, protesting that one of their videos was removed from the synod website. And then as a result of who knows what dynamics inside the Vatican, it was restored. And now they allegedly LGBT people have a voice. They have actually a channel by which things can be presented to the church. Look, to begin with, you can't consult with 120,000 people. There's going to be an immediate filtering process that takes place at the diocesan level. Then there are supposed to be national consultations. And by the way, I haven't seen a great deal of enthusiasm among bishops about this. I know a lot of bishops. And many of the ones that I do know, you know, when they meet together with their close-in advisors and staff in their dioceses, have many other concerns that are much more pressing. And yes, they're going to, you know, in America in particular, we follow what the Pope asks, and they're going to submit names of delegates and work up, you know, reports and whatnot. But I don't see enthusiasm, and I don't see great expectation, even among bishops. And it's somewhat similar to, just for a second, go to another topic, somewhat similar to the lack of response to the suppression of the traditional Latin Mass. Mm-hmm. You know, if it was as big a problem as the Vatican claimed from its polling of bishops, we would have seen bishops standing up all over the world saying, oh, thank you, Holy Father, you've saved us from these troublesome traditional Latin Mass people. But that hasn't happened.
Let's put a pin in that for 1 minute. We want to get to that topic in a moment. But just before we round out the synod, you know, for what it's worth, I've had the opportunity, that's one word to describe it, the opportunity to serve as the local facilitator / coordinator for the parish that I'm part of here in the Ottawa region. The pastor reached out and said he needed some help. So I was reading through the facilitator's guide that the archdiocese prepared. And one tries not to be instantaneously uncharitable with these things, but you read through the coordinator guide and you can't help but think that there's an element of reinventing the wheel when it comes to this process. I mean, it seems very navel-gazing. And among other things, it just seems like there are blinders in relation to what the beautiful 2,000-year tradition of the church has to offer in contemporary times. You read through that 30-page guide from the Archdiocese, you have no sense of the deposit of the faith, the catechism from various councils, the creed, the sacraments, the Sermon on the Mount, the Ten Commandments, the Beatitudes. There's very little sense of, okay, you know what? We're starting from a position of strength here. We've evangelized before. We've experienced Christendom before. There are ways to minister and serve people. You'd read through that guide and you would be left with no impression, with no sense that the church may be equipped to tackle the challenges of the 21st century. Instead, it just seems like, as I say, it seems like an appetite to reinvent the wheel by listening to ourselves. There's a huge emphasis on listening, but we're not listening to the word of God. We're not listening to the history of the church. At least that's not where we're being guided. And I can't help but think that any process, particularly within the church, where let's just listen to ourselves and each other and the solutions will come forth, I can't help but think that such a process is doomed to failure, or certainly not near as many fruits as folks are hoping for.
Yeah, I think thank God that your pastor has reached out to you, because you're informed and you know something about the tradition of the church. I can't say that that's going to be the case elsewhere. I have the impression that there are a lot of kind of progressive views that Vatican would like to see echoed back to them, and they'll pay special attention to them, mm-hmm. as opposed to this position of strength, as you rightly call it. Yeah, the people talk about revolutionary circumstances, that people are revolutionary not when they're oppressed, but when they are given a false sense of expectations or hopes that then are not going to ever be realized. And I think it's been one of the, I have to say, frankly, I think it's been one of the hallmarks of the papacy of Francis. He keeps saying, we shouldn't say we've always done things this way. And he kind of just holds out this openness. We're going to look to something else. Well, yeah, for certain issues, I suppose it's good to open up, because the church does need to find some new ways to evangelize in the modern world. But to create the expectation that everything is on the table, and I think that that expectation has been conveyed to a lot of people, is not only dangerous, because they're going to have false expectations, but it's false. A lot of questions have already been settled by the history of the church. A lot of very smart and very holy people have looked over the Old and New Testaments and the great saints who have existed, and the great teaching, the great doctors of the church. I often say about the Catholic tradition that there's nothing like it. There's such a large and rich tradition that there's just, you can't even look to anything that could be compared to it. And then it's 2,000 years old, and then you can even go back a couple thousand more into the Jewish history that flowed into Catholicism. So, look, we've got a lot of history. We shouldn't be only thinking about that history, but we should be looking at how a real tradition means to hand on something in a dynamic way. You have something that's good. You have a good, and it isn't just, you know, like a $10 bill handed from one generation to the next. It's dynamically carried on, and it grows, and it sprouts, and it has a different life from one age to the next. And the church has survived, and I often say it survived the rise and fall of entire civilizations, cultures, countries, continents, and it will get through this as well. But there are better and worse ways, of course, to do that.
Agreed. The more I've read about the synod, the more I've heard about it. Truthfully, the quote that keeps coming to mind is the famous one from G.K. Chesterton: "The Christian ideal has not been tried and left wanting. It has been found difficult and left untried." It's not that we don't know what to do. We have all the guidance, all the teaching, all the instructions in the world. We just need to go do the thing, the Catholic thing. With our remaining time, you referred earlier to the suppression of the extraordinary form, the traditional form of the Mass. I mean, I couldn't help but laugh in irony when I was reading in the Synod Facilitator's Guide how one of the key questions in this whole process is, what are the wounds of your church? How do you hurt for the church? And I thought, I mean, my goodness, I'll take you back to July 16th, 2021, with the motu proprio, Traditionis Custodes. One of the parishes we do attend here in the Ottawa region is a fraternity parish that celebrates Mass in the ancient rite. And when that motu proprio came out, that was a punch to the gut and a brick to the head. And for the first time in my life, it felt like that punch was delivered by the head of the church. And I know many of our fellow parishioners and other people who love the Latin Rite felt the same. And in that vein, if you don't mind the question, and with the synod looking at wounds, there was a pretty significant development in your professional life this year. Some of your colleagues at EWTN, you appear regularly on the channel. I mean, you were likewise singled out by the head of the church in some not so subtle swipe back in September on the return flight from Slovakia, when the Pope made reference to a large Catholic television network, which he described as doing the work of the devil. And I can't help but ask, how did that feel, those words coming from the successor of Peter?
Well, I say that I've often been told that I'm doing the work of the devil, but not by a Pope prior to this year. Look, it was distressing, but at the same time, I didn't pay too much attention to it personally, because the current group of people who advise the Holy Father really know nothing about the United States. In fact, not only do they not know nothing, what they do know is erroneous. It's mythological about what the America in its secular form is in the American churches, I believe. And at least in the shows that we do, the Papal Posse, we are critical. There's no question we are critical at a lot of what Pope Francis has done. But I don't think we've ever been disrespectful to him. I think we've always been trying to say, look, Holy Father, we're with you in wanting to make the church the best that it can be. I mean, obviously, if you talk about wounds, some of the wounds are the sexual abuse wounds that are very harmful. But there's also this fact that he himself, I think, was rigid, as he often puts it, when he was a younger man. And he's been in reaction to that because it got him into trouble when he was in Argentina, in his younger life, when he was the head of the Jesuits in Argentina. And so his personal reaction against that, I think, now colors the way that he looks at traditional matters. And it's just clear to anybody who knows anything about the way the Latin Mass has flourished here in North America and elsewhere, that it's mostly young people like yourself with families. It's not just some kind of antiquarian, you know, attempt to go back. I mean, he's puzzled. He actually says, you know, who wants to go back to that? They must be there's something off psychologically, which I wish he wouldn't do. I mean, this is kind of doing psychoanalysis at a distance of large groups of people who, for various reasons, find a certain dignity and uplifting spirit in the older form of the Latin Mass. I myself don't go to a Latin Mass parish. I grew up I'm old enough that I actually memorized that Latin Mass when I was in grade school. I could still recite it for you if you had time to do it. But I know what it does. I know what it did for me back then. And to realize that in the modern world, some people draw deep sustenance from that, and to just allow them to do that as long as they're faithful. I think that it was a red herring that some people told him that some of the people who go to traditional Latin masses reject Vatican II or everything that's happened since 1960. I think that's almost entirely false. There, you can always find, you know, extremists in any group, but I think that by and large, the people who go to traditional Latin masses are not, you would not characterize them that way. But this is just another example of one of the many things in the church that are going to have to be thrashed out. We still have not resolved many of the issues that were left us by Vatican II. And that's we thought that with Benedict and with John Paul II, who were not, you know, traditionalists in the usual sense. They were modern men. They engaged the modern world intellectually and politically and spiritually, you know, in all kinds of different ways. We thought that more authentic Vatican II had come to us. And now, this is a bit of a generalization, but I think with Francis, we are much more in a kind of a 1970s view of what Vatican II is. It's going to take a while to iron this out. And it's one of the crosses we bear as Catholics that we have to take our time and wait for the church to resolve these things.
That is a burden. It is a special cross, but as we've spoken about, it's also a blessing in terms of that tradition of tradition and looking back to inform the future. I want to end on a high note with our last question here. Looking ahead to 2022, the new year, what fills you with hope? What fills you with encouragement? What are you looking forward to?
Oh, boy. I think that we're going to be... As this synodal process goes forward, we may be surprised at some of the things that come out of it. Because, like your experience, several of the, obviously I would be in touch with people who, like you, have been tapped to be involved in the synodal process and are themselves sophisticated and informed Catholics. So I think some of the conversations we will have in the coming year will be good. I think some of the conversations among our American bishops are going to be interesting in the wake of that document that they produced. I wouldn't want to predict that there is going to be any major Copernican revolution in the next year or two. But look, we battle on. We're constantly in a church militant, as we used to say, that is struggling here on earth to become the church triumphant in heaven. And so one way to look at it is, if you're a Catholic in 2022, you won't be bored.
Well, just to echo that, as this year comes to the close, I mean, among the things for which I'm so grateful are our local parishes. My family, we alternate between a fraternity parish and the traditional rite, and Novus Ordo, if you will, diocesan parish, and all the pastors there are wonderful. It's amazing to see how those parishes have grown exponentially over the course of the COVID pandemic, because they were staffed by pastors who literally did nothing else but bend over backwards to make themselves available to the faithful, to administer the sacraments, and to affirm the importance of what we do as Catholics, to affirm, as you and your organization so beautifully call it, the Catholic thing. So Dr. Royal, thank you so much for being here on Crown and Crozier. For our listeners, you can read more of Dr. Royal's work at thecatholicthing.org. We wish you all the best and really appreciate your time with us here today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for tuning in. If you like what you heard, don't forget to subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcasts, and help us to reach more listeners by leaving us a rating or referring us to a friend. If you'd like to partner with us in the delivery of this podcast, head on over to our website at crownandcrozier.com and click the heart button in the top right-hand corner to learn more about making a one-time or monthly donation. We're sincerely grateful for you listening in, and we look forward to providing you with future episodes on church, state, and faithful citizenship. Until then, God bless.